Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your body.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK. Cygnos.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Sometimes to really understand a trial unfolding right in front of us, you have to look back a little bit, not just at the evidence, not just at the headlines of the day, but at the echoes. Because Donna Adelson, as unique as she may seem and feel, she's not. She's not the first narcissist to want to take the stand, to sit in her chair and pout and give this face and that face and try to manipulate others around her. There's been many others that have come prior to Donna Adelson. And on our very first live episode of Hidden Killers Live, we're going to be going through some of those moments all the way back to 1989, all the way to more recent day with Alec Murdaugh and others. Some of the other cases that tell us what we're seeing here, like I said, in 1989, San Diego society was transfixed by the story of a woman named Betty Broderick, the picture-perfect wife and mother who, after years of bitterness and control battles with her ex-husband, walked into his bedroom and executed both him and his new wife. Betty never showed remorse, and to this day, she insists she was the real victim, that the humiliation and loss of control justified the bloodshed. Fast forward, Donna Adelson, different facts, different courtroom, but the posture feels similar. The tight control, the cult logic, the rewriting of her own role. Like Betty, Donna positions herself as the aggravated matriarch, the one holding the family together. While the evidence suggests she was orchestrating its darkest act, this isn't just Betty. We've seen it with Pamela Smart, Susan Smith, Casey Anthony, defendants who believe they could control the narrative. Outsmart investigators and reframe reality itself don't always work out so well. So we watched Donna Adelson testify probably this week, sitting across from prosecutors. The real question won't be just about her words, but whether history is repeating itself. Of a defendant convicted or convinced, she can hold the story together even as it comes apart in real time. Joining me, obviously, welcome Stacy Cole, Todd Michaels. Yes, here we are. This is our first live edition of the program.
Exciting.
Yes, it is. And
did either of you sleep poorly last night worrying about this? Yeah, me too.
I was waking up and it was like the radio dream, except it was happening in my basement. And now it's come home. Now I got to just hang up the cap and call it a day. I was a little like, I don't know, but it's the same thing we're doing every day. We're just live now. So I want to say and welcome everybody who's watching us out there on YouTube, on X or Twitter or Facebook or wherever it may be. Please join in. Tell us your thoughts on the cases that we're following here. We'll go to you from time to time and see what your thoughts are. And at some point, a phone number will be introduced. That is, that's coming. We'll be able to hear each other's voices. It's this concept. It's really neat. It's really neat. People are so, they don't do that anymore. People don't use the phone. People don't have conversations much. It's always texting. It's always this. It's always that. We're the old people now. But it's true. I mean, I've noticed it over on our other program, Real Ghost Stories Online, just people, they'd rather write in their story. They'd rather than call it in these days. It's different. I don't know. I think you lose something there, though.
Is there somebody in your life that you've never spoken to on the phone? Because somebody just popped up into my head that I've known for a little bit that
never spoken to on the phone.
Never spoken. We've texted. We've seen each other in person. I've never spoken on the phone.
No. Not that I can think of. I have been in relationships. I'm in one now. I've been with her for 6 months, so it's just me and her. But prior to that, there had been like where it would have been like a month or two into the relationship before there was an actual phone call. So, yeah.
Isn't that bizarre?
It is, because it's just texting. Yeah. Someone who had some issues with communicating with their significant other, Betty Broderick. We'll go all the way back to 1989. And let's take a look at this case. You're going to see a lot of interesting connections in terms of demeanor. I think that's the biggest thing with this. The demeanor of Betty Broderick, the attitude of Betty Broderick, very much... It's her world, and everybody else is playing along in it. In this first clip we're going to take a look at, she isn't describing a plan to murder. She's describing a mission, really, of self-preservation, that she simply had to make it stop. The victims vanish. Her pain becomes the justification, a lot like Donna Adelson. Take a look.
Should have had this queued up. Stand by. It's coming.
Gosh, Todd, this is our first day.
I remember leaving my house, backing out of the driveway and leaving. I remember that, but I don't remember at which point I decided where I was when I decided not to go to the beach and go to Dan's house. All the way to Dan's house, I was just thinking, I've just got to make this stop. I just got to make this stop. I'm not going to live another day like this. I can't wake up just being absolutely at his mercy anymore. So all the way there, I just kept thinking, I've got to make this stop. And I don't remember what even road I took to get there.
It's an interesting way. I mean, look at her prism. Look at the way she's looking at things. And this is more of a psychological study, I think, by watching her than it is. She's just like Donna. It's look at the way she's framing it. Because if you want to try and understand Donna, and I think that's the hardest thing everyone's having to do, you got to understand how her prism works. And look how Betty's works here. It was still about her. It was about, I got to make this stop. What do you have to make stop? I mean, you have agency, but so oftentimes people forget that little fact.
They do. And did you catch the cadence in which she spoke?
Mm-hmm.
That really caught my attention, that she felt, it didn't seem like panic or fear. It felt like, this is something I rehearsed. You people need to hear exactly what I'm saying. It felt rehearsed to me.
Yes.
Yep.
I would say solutions oriented. In if you're speaking like a corporate human being, you know, mm-hmm. where it's like, right. We're very solutions oriented here. We like to find paths to solve problems. And I'm just going to speak in these terms for the next 35 minutes. You'll get nothing out of it. But we're going to find solutions that are oriented to solving the problems or the problems that we have here. That's like every corporate everything. Yeah. But it's. She's talking about it more like, I needed to get Tide Pods, the ones without bleach, because the bleach ones, they make my skin kind of itchy. So I had to get those. Just with this, the cadence you were talking about of not the gravity of what it is.
Yeah.
You know, someone else who talked about things that didn't have gravity, it seemed to them, Karen Reed. That was another case where she never took the stand, but in interviews, she talked very much of just matter of fact. And at some point, you have to look at the cases, go though, and say, okay, you're drilled with this day in and day out, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is all people are talking to you about. At some point, yeah, you can't really be shocked at some point, I guess. I mean, because right. No matter how horrible the thing is, and whether, and I'm not going into accused or not accused, I'm not going to go into the Karen stuff, but at some point it does become kind of second nature. And then people are ready to pounce and say, well, you don't have enough grief, enough empathy, enough this or that, or is it, you know, this is the, you know, 50th time I've had to discuss this today.
Well, and people do find coping mechanisms. They put those walls up. They have to find a way to deal with things. Mm-hmm. And emotion leaves because you need to protect your inner sanctum, you know? And mm-hmm. so if you're grieving every time you talk about this story, you're just living in a state of panic and fear, and people can't persist that way. So I guess I can give a little bit of grace to somebody who's not showing a lot of emotion, but boy, when you're on the stand,
yeah,
I need to see something. You need to get really down deep and find that grief that you had before.
Well, and here's the thing. People do get into survival mode. And mm-hmm. and that's, you know, and then to protect the inner sanctum. I get that. But a narcissist like a Betty Broderick, a narcissist like a Donna Adelson, they're always protecting the inner sanctum. It's not a mode that they have to flip into when
lifestyle.
Things get really bad. It is a lifestyle. And it's always about that. And that's why they're always thinking eight steps ahead, or they think they are. And that's where you can better understand the motive. And then sometimes the poor decisions that they make as time progresses of, I have to be the pure one. Everything I'm doing here has to be the right thing. I'm doing it and it's all for the right cause. And you end up then, you know, putting $100 bills with Tide Pods in your washing machine and giving them to your son stapled together. Let's look more at Betty, because here's another interesting piece from back in 89 here. When pressed, Betty is not describing rational thought. She's describing anguish. She's painting herself as so overwhelmed that the outside world no longer existed. Sound like Donna or anything? Psychological fog where she, not her victims. Center stage, check it out.
Were you clear thinking and seeing things clearly at that time?
The only way I can explain it.
Sustained. How would you describe how the world seemed to you at that time? Sustained. Your Honor, I would like to make an offer of proof why it hasn't been. If I'm referring to how she was physically seeing the world at that time, it may be different than she's answered before.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. You can answer that.
Well, the only way I know how to describe it now is that there was all these thoughts just churning in my head. And there was so much going on inside my head. Is that's kind of like my eyeballs were turned backwards and the whole world was inside my head because of all this anguish. And so I wasn't seeing where I was going, and it was like I was just inward and there was all this anguish and kind of darkness and crazy thoughts. Felt like you were in hell, actually.
She's the glamour shots of narcissism.
Oh, that's one of the first things I thought of. It reminded me of a picture that my mom had done, glamour shots at the mall in the 80s.
And I'm not
like the pinnacle year for glamour shots.
And I'm not just saying it because she looks like she probably went to Cinnabon, decided glamour shots was a good idea.
Yes.
Got on the list, probably went back out to Hot Sam, got a pretzel, and then walked around. Finally got called into glamour shots.
She went to Claire's first. Don't forget Claire's.
Yeah. Maybe stopped at the Deb for a few moments. Maybe Id. And then she decided it was time to get that glamour shot done. But no, you know how glamour shots, everything is so overly accentuated because it's glamour shots.
Theatrics.
She is that with her narcissism and her theatrics. Yes. Mm-hmm. Everything about it. I know a lot of people are listening to this, but if you're watching it on YouTube, if you're not, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. You can see the theatrics. You can see this is probably about what Donna, you know, about Donna's age in 89. So this woman I'm sure is right up there with Donna. And this I'm going to guess is probably the type of theatrics we would have seen out of Donna back at that moment in time, maybe a little more over the top. Now she seems a little more, I don't know, run down a little more. I've been doing these theatrics. Y'all better just deal with my theatrics, because that's how it is. But
if you're listening, though, did you notice like she whimpered while she was waiting for them to decide whether or not she could answer the question? She kind of went, mm-hmm. And I hate to laugh at somebody else's unhappiness, but I actually giggled at that.
She was like, she was getting ready for her moment. You could tell. It was like we're sitting here waiting for the camera. Like we're waiting for the countdown. And you're kind of like, okay, is Mike ready? Is this ready? She was like, she was prepping herself for that moment when it was going to be question showtime. And she went for it. Selective amnesia is another interesting thing. We've saw that with Wendy Adelson, another narcissistic tactic. When it's too harsh to deal with, I don't remember. She remembers arriving, opening the door and grabbing her phone. But the act itself, that part is just a blur. A lot of gaps in her memory here in when we look back at Betty Broderick. Let's take a look.
I want to go at least as much as we can step by step. How would you describe your memory of that event? Do you have a clear memory of everything that happened?
What I can tell you in words now is it seems like a slideshow where slides are missing. You know, I remember driving up to the front of the house. I remember the front of the house, but I don't remember if I went to the front door, and I don't remember going around. And then I know I was upstairs, and I remember opening the door to the bedroom. So I see myself doing that, but then I don't see anything else. And then I know I grabbed the phone, but I don't remember leaving the house or running down the stairs or anything. So it's like there's these spots missing. It's like a flash of this, and then she's over there, and there's a flash of that.
Who's watching themselves in third person?
That's an interesting, you know, I wonder, did she step out of her own body during this moment, that she's not seeing it from her perspective, but kind of an out-of-body experience? I know that sounds a little woo-woo, but...
Well, I mean, I get that that probably does happen to some people. I don't feel that it's happening to her. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I feel like this is... I don't know. She just seems so staged with it. The same way that Donna seems staged with it. The same way Murdaugh seems staged with it. There are certainly times where, you know, trauma, I think, takes over. But this was more of a planned thing. I mean, this isn't, you know, you walked in and she found, you know, her husband cheating with somebody else. And then it was a fit of rage. And that's where those things can happen, the little flashes here and there. Yeah, when you plan it out and you're this kind of, you know, calm and collected about it. She transforms an execution into an accident. The gun just went off, she says. She doesn't remember pulling the trigger. This is one of the many changes to her story as her testimony continued on. It's a way of doing the act without ever actually owning the intent. Let's take a look.
And what happened when they went towards, what's the next thing you remember after they went towards the phone and said, call the police?
I kind of like screamed, like this huge scream, like, no! And the gun went off, and I just remember one time and one noise. But I know that I must have done that because you have to do that on the gun. But it was so fast. I just went,
Now, did you scream out loud?
I felt like I made a huge scream, but I don't know if I made any noise. It was just all sensation. You move in, and then they moved, and then it was this huge explosion and scream and all at once.
Do you remember actually pulling the trigger?
No.
Is that a gun where you have to pull the trigger?
Yes, I asked people that day, do you have to pull the trigger? And they told me that you had to, but I don't remember pulling it even the first time.
I hate laughing at this, but I feel like I need to.
Yeah.
Especially as, and not to, you know, discredit you guys as men, but as a woman, I want to be on her side. But there's just something here that I just...
She's lying like a 5-year-old.
That's what it feels like to me, and I feel bad about it.
Yeah, it's there's a cadence to it. There's a rhythm to it.
I've never heard of a gun that you don't have to pull the trigger on. That would just seem like such an odd question.
They told me you have to pull it. They went, whoa, it exploded in my hands. It was whoa. And well, the only time that happened was when me and him were on our honeymoon and it went, woo, and it exploded in my hands. And I said, never again.
Tony went there.
I was just going to say, how many minutes in?
almost 20 down. Minutes in, almost 20 minutes into the live show.
But, 22, I think.
Well, we're starting 20. A drinking game on this. Good morning, everyone. A little
Kahlua in the coffee. I would have had, Tony, I would have had money on me, but.
Yeah. You know, you got to get out to the come and go, get your gas and everything. And, you know,
we'll get there.
This is another interesting look at Betty Broderick and her way of thinking as we compare it to Donna Adelson. This is Betty going on, only Betty going on, spinning jail as a sanctuary. In her telling, incarceration wasn't about accountability. It was about safety and finally free from Dan's power. So, of course, the world aligned to fit her. It wasn't that it was the other way around, the way things are actually going. Once again, she becomes a protected victim, not the perpetrator. Take a look.
When you first got to jail, how were you feeling?
I don't remember getting taken there. I know they put me in a suicide cell, stark naked for the first night I was there. And I was just kind of, I was real shocking, and I don't remember being there or what much of what happened. I was just kind of, I just went where people told me to go. Yeah.
Now that first day or the first couple of weeks that you were there, how were you feeling emotionally or mentally?
It's hard to just, I was very confused, but I was safe in jail. You know, they locked the rest of the world out when they locked me in this little corner cell. And that was good for me because then Dan couldn't get me.
I bet there's a level of truth to that in her way. I mean, she does believe the things she's saying to a certain extent. It's just she says it so matter-of-factly, it looks so ridiculous to the rest of us, but she seems to be completely oblivious to that fact. You know, she can just keep going.
Is it possible that she's been so steeped in this, in a horrific relationship, that this is just who she is now? And even though it's wrong, what she did was wrong, this is who she became?
I'm going to guess it's the other way around, quite honestly. And seeing the kids' testimony on it, too, I watched them yesterday. They were on Oprah back in the early 90s talking about it. You know, was she so steeped? She wants you to believe she was steeped in a horrible relationship and she was a victim. Who was the one that created the horrible relationship? I'm going to guess it was more her. And then because it was so horrible, of this hellscape that she created and no one's happy, she's going to blame other people rather than herself. And what does she do to still think she's a victim? She kills the people who she's enraged, or the person that she enraged, by being a horrible person to them. That's how narcissists react. That's what they do. They act horrible to you. And then when you finally react in some way, shape, or form, even if it's the smallest thing, some people will be very calm. I'm a calm person. Some people get like out of control, like, what's wrong with you? You know, but no matter anything you react to them, you are going to be the one that's wrong, because they are always going to be the one that is right. And they are their reactions to you, their horrible acting out, their tantrums, all of that is called for because of what you're doing over here, or not doing, or not giving them the attention. So I would think that's probably more of what's actually going on in that world, and especially from the testimony of her kids. On that old Oprah episode. This is a fascinating case. If anybody wants to get in and take a look at it from back in the day, there are a lot of correlations here between Donna and her. Let's take a look at one more thing. Then we'll take a look at some Alec Murdaugh testimony as we prepare ourselves for Donna as she gets ready to testify this week. Here is one more from Betty. She's rationalizing why no one ever heard her express remorse. It's not that she didn't feel it, she says. It's that she couldn't share it. A dodge that lets her remain the misunderstood victim rather than the unrepentant killer. Take a look.
Did you write letters to newspaper reporters?
I corrected some articles. Yes, I corrected articles that I read that were wrong. Okay.
And did you write letters to celebrities, for example?
I don't know what you're referring to.
Did you write to Cindy Garvey?
Oh, I don't remember. Did I? I don't know.
There was nothing ever preventing you from saying anything about your feelings about what had happened in any of those letters that you wrote, was there?
No.
You were free to express your feelings about what had happened and how you felt about it, correct?
Yes.
And you had many phone calls, many phone conversations with people shortly after your incarceration, in which you were free to express your feelings about what had happened.
Well, I've already testified I wasn't free to express any feelings, really, because I knew the letters were copied coming in and going out and that the phone calls are listened to constantly. So and even the visits are listened to. So everyone was pretty paranoid about that.
You were advised that the phone calls were not monitored. Your phone calls were never monitored.
Oh, I don't know that.
Okay. Are you saying that you felt that you couldn't express any of your feelings about what had happened because you felt it was that your letters were being monitored?
Yes.
And how would that hurt you or your case to say that you felt sorry for what you had done?
How would it hurt my case to say
How did
that?
The fact that you were being monitored prevent you from expressing your feelings like you've indicated? No one would let you express your feelings.
Because it just inhibited everything. I didn't know who would interpret those and get copies and switch everything around.
So are you indicating that you felt inhibited about talking to people about what occurred?
Yes.
You did write a letter, for example, to Amy Wallace shortly after you were in jail, correct?
That would have been one of the corrections of an article, I believe.
And in that letter, you start off by saying, I have pages and pages of notes setting the story straight, incident by incident. In most cases, you have the general idea, but the chronology and the facts are all twisted around. I'll call. We can talk. Neighbors and friends have bits and pieces. Only I know the whole truth. Are you saying that you were inhibited about telling her the whole truth as you saw it?
I was just correcting her article. Whatever she said that I felt was wrong, I wanted corrected.
Okay. Are you saying that you were inhibited about saying anything that you wanted to correct anything that had been
Yes.
written about you?
Yes, because I wouldn't have expressed the feelings that I'm talking about to a strange newspaper reporter.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, this is what Don is setting her ass up for on cross.
Well, and here's the thing. They both seem to have this, I guess, appearance that if I can just tell my story, you guys are going to believe me and I'll be vindicated.
Mm-hmm.
And your story's bullshit.
Yep. and oblivious to that. You wrote letters to, oh, did I? I might have. Maybe I did.
Don't be coy. Don't be coy on the stand.
Yeah.
You know? That's not the time or place.
They're clueless. Clueless, I tell you.
But to have that kind of confidence, if I could wake up in the morning and have that kind of confidence to rule my day, I could own the world.
It makes you wonder, though, how have these people like not accidentally driven off of a cliff? I mean, in many ways they are. I mean, this is the metaphorical version of them driving off a cliff, but physically driving off a cliff, I wonder about too, where they're just like, that looks so beautiful. Maybe I should go over there. Woo! Jesus!
No, not in the Thelma and Louise kind of drive off a cliff, just a stupidity drive off a cliff.
Yeah. Like they're convinced their cat Toonsis can drive a car and they're like,
yes.
Let's go. Toonsis, the driving cat.
If you haven't seen Toonsis, you need to look it up. It's an SNL skit. It's
yes.
worth it.
One of the things that really stood out to me was in the Donna Adelson trial, when the people who really knew what they were talking about, the investigators, all that kind of stuff, she glared at them. Mm-hmm. And you saw that same thing in that last clip because somebody was questioning her on something that they had knowledge of.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She didn't like it. So her demeanor was completely different.
Yep.
So it's somebody that she can't control. She can control that bubble of her family, but on the outside are people who are not under her spell. So mm-hmm. how dare you question me? And it's that loss of control, and you start to see that panic come out as rage.
Yeah. They don't know how to handle it because most of their life they've had it really in check.
Yep.
Until now.
Yeah.
That's going to be exciting to see this week if, in fact, Donna does take the stand. As of now, I believe that is the plan. So
she better. I mean, we're looking forward to this.
Today, as of right now, as ever recording this, there are other people on the stand for the defense. So they are calling other witnesses. I mean, Donna could be up as soon as today. I don't know. I've not dove into today's proceedings yet, but that's going to be, we're going to watch that thing, I think, straight through. And probably comment when that takes place.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Want to try a free sample?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
You only eat after you're walking 10,000 steps.
Stop it.
They don't know your body, only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK, Cygnos.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.